Welcome, it's so nice to see you again, as well as a few new faces in addition. We are going to be going on a wonderful journey this morning as well. We're going to be covering the material we had asked you to read, chapters 18 through 25, covering a few different themes. I just realized that it's quite coincidental that chapter 18, which of course brings up to mind the word chai, deals with health and life. Health is a mitzvah. We cover health, enjoyment of life, the seven universal laws, the mitzvah of study as the greatest mitzvah of all, and then the summing up in this particular session. And I'd like to begin with a discussion of that all-important theme of health as a mitzvah, and expand upon something that I have in the book. Yes, obviously, in order to perform mitzvot, we've got to be alive and well. Therefore, we've got to keep ourselves well. We have to ensure that we maintain properly that greatest gift which God gives us, which is life. One could indeed say that the supreme sin in Judaism is suicide. And suicide can sometimes be accomplished not in a moment, but over a period of time. People can kill themselves over a lengthy period of time by not taking care of themselves, which is why the Torah teaches us that take care of your souls, take care of your lives is a supreme mitzvah. And in fact, Pikuach nefesh doche et hakol. The preservation of life transcends everything. One may violate every and any law in the Torah in order to be alive and be well, because you will transgress only once and give yourself, hopefully, many more years in which you will fulfill mitzvot. So important is that theme of health that there is an implicit suggestion in a biblical text that perhaps may be the purpose of all of mitzvot. I'd like to stress that for you and discuss its implications by taking you to Shemot, Exodus, chapter 15, verse Chafvav 26. God has just given the Jews a few laws prior to Mount Sinai. Indeed, there are some halachot, there are some mitzvot and laws, which precede revelation. They had to be given earlier. It's almost as if God couldn't wait. And at a place called Marah, we are taught that God did indeed give several laws. And then he said the following words. Vayomer, Im shamoa tishma lekol ha'Hashem Elokecha, if you will listen well, the word is repeated, listen, to the voice of the Lord your God, v'hayosha b'yenov tase, and do that which is right, v'hazanto l'mitzvosav, and give ear to his mitzvos, v'shomarto kol chukov, and observe all of his chukim, which will translate temporarily as statutes, then what will the result be of a mitzvah life? Listen carefully. Kol ha-machalo asher samti v'mitzrayim, all the sickness which I gave to Egypt, lo osim olecho, I will not give to you. Ki ani aroshem rofecho, for I am the Lord your doctor. Now you know why so many Jewish boys want to be doctors. We're supposed to imitate God. And if you ask me, what is God's profession? There are a few which we are taught in the Torah. They therefore become ideal professions. Obviously, God is a teacher. God also makes shiduchim. God brings men and women together. That's a good job. And another great job for a Jewish boy is to be a doctor. Ki ani Hashem rofecha. For I am the Lord your God. I am a doctor. That's in context of God saying, observe mitzvot. You do the mitzvot and you won't have the sicknesses placed upon Egypt. I will be your doctor, literally your healer. Some commentators ask, if God is saying you won't have the sickness, then what do you need a doctor for? Doctors heal you when you're ill. But if God is saying that you won't even get sick, then why is he saying, I am your rofe? And the answer to that, I think, is extremely significant, because a great doctor doesn't just cure you when you're sick. He sees to it that you don't get sick in the first place. I read somewhere that in China, they pay doctors when they're well. If you get sick and you need them to cure you, then obviously they didn't do their job of preventative medicine well enough. But let me bring you back to the text now. This is remarkable. God is saying, keep the law, then you will be well. All the sicknesses will not be placed upon you. I am your rofe. Therefore, mitzvot make you well. Which mitzvot? God spoke here of laws, mitzvot, and chukim, v'shamarta kol chukav. The first major point to be made here is with regard to two categories of Jewish law. You know that we speak of chok and we speak of mishpat, and the simple distinction between these two is that mishpatim are laws that are logical. You don't have to be Jewish to know that stealing, that murdering are not good things to do. Chukim are laws which some people incorrectly translate as illogical laws. Now, God doesn't do anything that's illogical. Some people say there are laws which have no reason. Well, that doesn't make sense either. If they're not reasonable, why should we be asked to do them? Almost all Jewish philosophers say that chukim have reasons, but they are incomprehensible to us at present. We may find out eventually what they are. We may not. The test may be to observe them even when we don't understand why. After all, if you knew that poison kills you and somebody told you, don't drink poison, the fact that you're staying away from it doesn't really make you a very good person who's listening to what the other individual tells you. You're not drinking it because you know of a certainty that it's harmful. Will you do it just because God said so? That's the implicit test in a chok. But a chok is reasonable. That is to say, there is a rationale for it, which you may or may not know. The text makes clear that every chok does have a reason. For if you observe the laws, including the chukim, then kol ha-machla, all the sickness you will not have, I'm your healer. Listen to the words of Rashi, very significant. Ki ani Hashem rofecha, for I am the Lord your doctor. U'melamedcha Torah, and the Torah is teaching you, u'mitzvot, and giving you laws, leman tinotzel mehem, in order to be saved through them, kirofe hazel, like this doctor, ha'omer li'adam, who says to a person, al tochel dvarim shemachzir moscho lidei choli, do not eat things which will make you sick. You go to a doctor, he tells you, he's a good doctor, this is what you should eat, this is what you shouldn't eat. God gave us laws in order to make sure that we survive. God is a doctor giving us a proper diet with regard to food as well as with regard to everything else in life. That is the purpose, Rashi is telling us, of mitzvot. Yes, you have a question?
Rabbi, if you're saying that mitzvot are primarily for health reasons, why is it that so many non-Jews are just as healthy?
We should add, very often healthier. I try to keep Torah mitzvot, and I'm not in as good shape as Schwarzenegger. There must be some reason, and we have to understand the intent of this Rashi, who's really repeating a very important opinion of Chazal, of our sages, we have to interpret that on a deeper level. We must understand what he is saying. And I'm so glad you asked it, because it allows me to expand on an idea which I think we need as a preliminary to answering your question. I will get to a full response. If you allow me first to share with all of you something that Maimonides said in terms of explanation of the laws of Kashrut. The laws of Kashrut are a perfect example of the category of Chok. We're not given a reason. God simply says, these animals are kosher, these are non-kosher, or treif. Maimonides says, I think I have a possible explanation. Please understand, and Maimonides stresses this, that it's always dangerous to give a reason. In case you give the wrong reason for a law, people either may scoff and say, well, that's silly, and reject the law, or if the reason then becomes voided because you can cure the problem, for example, if you said that the reason for not eating pig is trichinosis and you can get rid of trichinosis, then you'll say pig is permissible. It's very dangerous to give a reason. Maimonides understands that. And he says, I'm just saying this in order to make the law more palatable. The law is the law no matter what. However, this is what I think is a very valid possibility to explain why these animals are off limits and these animals are permitted to be eaten. Doesn't it make sense that you are what you eat? That is to say, things that you eat can affect you in tremendous ways. If you drink to excess, you begin to think differently. Maimonides doesn't use this illustration, but if you take the smallest grain of LSD, that can really change your thinking, your perspective. It can change you totally. You become a different person based on what you ingest. That, of course, is a reality that we all understand. Now, the Rambam, Maimonides, makes this fascinating suggestion. We're taking in things that become part of ourselves. They become our body. If you take a look at the category of forbidden animals, that is to say, those which are labeled treif, they are carnivorous. That is to say, they tear apart other animals in order to get their food. The animals which are kosher are herbivorous. They are animals which live off grass, which live off the fields. They are more docile, one might even say more peace-loving animals. Suppose we ingested not only the meat of the animal, but the essence of the animal. Suppose, in fact, by not eating carnivorous animals, we don't have the same lust for tearing apart others, for war, for the kinds of activities that are basic and necessary to carnivorous animals. We eat herbivorous animals, and we become more like them, loving and giving and non-aggressive. Now, if we were to say that you're healthier when you eat kosher, with the background of Maimonides, what would we mean by that? You see, Western mentality defines health simply in physical terms. You're healthy means you feel good. But someone could be very healthy. I'm so healthy right now. I feel so strong right now. I want to go out and mug somebody. Do you understand? There is all the difference in the world between physical health and total spiritual health, mental health, human health. So I am certain that what Rashi intended and what our sages intended, when they said, obey the law, it comes from the doctor on high, we didn't simply mean physical health, because then you would be absolutely correct. There are people who are, quote, healthier than us, if one gauges health by the standard of Rabbi Akiva, was a few hours again. So it's almost like you tell people the story with the mister. To be healthy, you must be healthy. A psychiatrist must say you're healthy. You're healthy in your mind. You're healthy in your emotions. You're healthy totally. I've had the privilege of personally meeting some of the Gedolim, some of the holy men of our past generation. I was with Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal. I was with Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal, who was my teacher. What one has to understand in meeting people of that caliber is the radiance that emanated from them, the peace and tranquility. I would say the word is the shleimut, the wholeness. They were complete human beings. They were perfect human beings. And they...
there had been killed. It was a band of marauding robbers who had...
a glow of good spiritual health because they were in touch with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God. And that, I am sure, is what Rashi meant. And that is what the significance is of attaching mitzvah observance to well-being. It is a total well-being that transcends physical good health. You know that if we speak of good health as being a mitzvah, then it should also be clear that asceticism is not an ideal in Judaism, especially the kind of asceticism that leads to harming oneself physically. Obviously, that's the antithesis to taking good care of yourself and keeping yourself in such a manner that you will be able to serve God in a better way.
If the Torah is against asceticism, why does it permit people to take oaths of Nazirut and allow themselves to abstain from various pleasures in this world?
That's a wonderful question. Indeed, we know that the Nazir takes a vow depriving himself of drink and saying that he will not cut his hair, which, fascinatingly enough, according to the commentators, means just what growing hair long has meant during the time of the hippies, removal from society and its values. It's going away from the world. And a Nazir cut himself off from pleasure, drink being the supreme symbol, and from social contact. Yes, I indicated in the book, you know that when he finishes his enforced period of Nazirut, which he accepted upon himself, he must bring a karbana sacrifice of chatos, a sin offering. He has got to admit publicly that he committed a sin, as our sages put it. What he was expressing was a feeling that the laws given by God weren't sufficient. God, you allowed me to do this, but I think I have to be even stricter. I am going to add some kind of restrictions that don't even appear in the Torah. And because he does, he brings a sin offering. I'm merely reiterating your question and strengthening it. If God is indeed so opposed to this, if it's not something that he approves of, why in the world does it work? Why doesn't God simply say, if you declare that you want to be a Nazir, you're going against what I think is correct, and therefore there is no such thing? The answer, again, is something that we can deduce from
a fascinating concept taught to us by Maimonides, the primary theologian of the Jewish people. I think you've got to put the Nazir into a certain context. Who becomes a Nazir, and why is he allowed to become a Nazir? Here is a man who is giving up pleasure. Let me teach you the principle as the Rambam expresses it, and then apply it specifically to the Nazir. The Rambam says that people may go astray and bend to an extreme. Imagine this mushal, this parable. Imagine you have a piece of metal which is supposed to stand straight, and it bends in some way. It's bending, it's off-center, it goes like so. In order to rectify it, in order to bring it back to its proper position, there are times when I've got to bend it way over to the other side in order to bring it where? Back to the middle, where it should be. The middle is where it is supposed to be. But because it bent so far to the right, I've got to bend it the other way for it to end up where it should be. Now, there are times when a person bends too far to an extreme. Let's give an illustration with regard to drink. You know that we make kiddush. We're supposed to enjoy a glass of wine, and we sanctify God in that way. Even as I indicated in the text, when we get to the other world, one of the questions God asks us is, are there any pleasures which I created for you on this earth that you didn't take advantage of? Remember when God created the world, he gave a verdict on everything that he created. And what was that verdict? Tov, ki tov, ki tov, ki tov. It is good. For an individual not to drink a glass of wine ever would be to say, lo tov, this is no good. So we should have a glass of wine, and we use it for kiddush. We don't drink too many cups because we know what happens to us then. Hopefully, we can control ourselves. But imagine, if you will, and it isn't too hard to imagine because we see many illustrations of it in the world, someone who can't discipline himself or herself enough and goes to an extreme in drink. They then go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in order to cure themselves of this extreme. And what are they told? You are not to touch a drop. Don't touch it, because in order to get away from your overuse or abuse of wine, you've got to stay away from it totally. What I'm saying to you is, the center is an ideal, yes. It's the golden mean of Aristotle, which for us is also Derech HaMemutza, the middle of the road, which is the principle for the correct way of life. But there are times when the only way we can get you to the Derech HaMemutza, the middle of the road, is to veer you away from your one extreme by temporarily putting you into another. And so let's get back to your question. Is there ever a time when we, God, the Torah, allows for someone to become a, quote, temporary ascetic? Yes. If he can't handle drink and socializing in a manner that allows him to be center, then he can take a vow which is approved and not approved by God at one and the same time. Approved for him, but when he concludes his time period of abstinence from wine, from socializing, we say to him, now bring a korban chatas, a sin offering. For what reason? To indicate that the cause which justified your temporary extreme to the left was really improper. What we're getting is a combination. We're getting a reflection on from the part of God about the behavior that caused the validity of this action for a time. What a beautiful concept. The ascetic may perhaps at times be given permission to go ahead with his ascetic behavior because he was an extreme hedonist. The extreme hedonist can become an ascetic so that you've bent the stick back to the way in which finally we will come to the center, the Derech HaMemutza, which is the ideal. There's one more all-important point I want to make in this discussion on health and the mitzvah of health. I think I would be irresponsible if I didn't at least say it. I can't see the people watching this. I hope we don't have a smoking section, because that's the issue I'd like to address. The Surgeon General has determined that smoking is dangerous to health. If that's the case, then I must say to you, in light of that all-important mitzvah, Shmartem Yodes Nafshoseichem, that you shall guard your souls, your lives, you must take care of yourselves, then how strongly shall I put it? Smoking is an avera. Smoking is a sin.
Rabbi, if I might ask you, you're asserting that smoking is forbidden by Jewish law, but it's surely my observation that there's not an insignificant segment of the observant community that is in fact smoking, including many Talmidei Chachamim and even poskim. What do you make of such a situation?
That is an extremely difficult question to answer, and I grant the validity of your observation. It is true. But how shall we put it? I don't know how to say it other than in a very blunt way. There are times when things were done because people didn't know better, and hence it couldn't be labeled an avera. It wasn't called a sin if they thought it was recreational. But we now know better. We're treading on somewhat dangerous ground, because it almost seems as if I'm saying we know better about halacha. We have to make a distinction. Obviously, this would not be true in any other area with regard to a law. We don't know better about a law, but we can know more about the application of a law. If the basis of the law is take care of yourself, health, and we now know that something which was assumed to be non-injurious is in fact injurious, then it is forbidden because it falls under this new category. In defense of the people who smoke, one would have to say they began their activity at a time when everyone was smoking. Certainly, they didn't know it was sinful. I have heard some of them use a verse which says that God protects the innocent. That is to say, if in all innocence they did this, there is a measure of divine protection. I can accept that to some extent, but certainly not for people who grow up today and are told, there is no question about it, the statistics are clear, that you are shortening your life. That means, as I said before, suicide can be achieved in one of two ways, immediate or long-lasting. It is hard to condemn and criticize those who are caught in the grip of a horrible habit, and that's not my intent to be condemnatory. They probably say to themselves, I can't help it, but I know many Talmidei Chachamim who recognize that if now I know better, then the I can't help it approach doesn't mean anything. I've got to change. and who have taken themselves in hand and given up a habit which they now know is harmful to them. Others, what can I say? One can't adduce law from practices of people, but one should recognize reality. And with regard to cigarette smoking, as with regard to some other areas that are part and parcel of popular culture, that at one time seemed to be nothing other than pleasant ways in which to pass your time, like smoking marijuana, whether you inhale or not, smoking marijuana on a regular basis, where we now see that it is injurious. Certainly, heroin and hard drugs. If we could learn from our religious perspective, not only to say, this is a cultural question that has to do with habits and let psychologists deal with it, let doctors deal with it. We have to address it religiously. We must say that when something is harmful, it is religiously forbidden. That is an all-important concept, and we have to learn to apply it in our own lives. We've made clear that Judaism is concerned with health. Judaism is concerned with life. Judaism is concerned with this world. And I must take a few moments to share with you a remarkable story. It's a story that I've written up, and I think the entire world should really know the events that I experienced with somebody who is world-renowned, Ernest Hemingway. With a stroke of good luck, some friends and I were in Cuba many years ago. This was pre-Castro, and we had just gotten smicha. We were ordained. We wanted not only to see the country, but we had also heard that Ernest Hemingway lives there. We drove by the estate, and we told the person at the door, please tell Mr. Hemingway, three rabbis are waiting to speak to him. We figured that might work, and lo and behold, it did. He was so intrigued that he asked us to wait a little, and we eventually were ushered into his presence. Sitting there was the ambassador to the United States. Mary was there. He began to talk to us first, and I could sense that what he really was doing was testing us to see whether we had any intelligence and whether it was worthwhile speaking to us. But once we passed the test, Ernest Hemingway revealed something that I have never seen recorded anywhere by his biographers. He said to us, most people don't know that I have been interested in religion for a long time, and I have made it my business to read up on the religions of the world. He said, I have done a study of almost all the religions there are, and I noticed one thing that makes Judaism different from all the others. That's intriguing. Here is a man with his intelligence. What is he going to say is the uniqueness of Judaism? And lo and behold, with his insight, he in fact pinpointed precisely that area that we should be sensitive to. He was absolutely correct. He said, any other religion I studied emphasizes death. The religion is merely a preparation for the other world. And he said, Judaism, what I know of it, is unique in that it is a religion of life and not a religion of death. How remarkable. The very same fact that makes a Kohen, the religious leader of the Jewish people, not be someone whose specialty is death, but someone who isn't even allowed to have contact with the dead. That point was perceived by Ernest Hemingway. And what, of course, makes it all the more remarkable is he said to us, I could never really feel any close-knit identification with Christianity because I wasn't interested in preparing for an afterlife. I wanted to know how to live this life. You all know the ending. Ernest Hemingway could not resolve the problem of living this life, and he committed suicide. What an incredible ending to a story which we discovered much, much later. We are a religion of life and not of death.
fascinating, and the next subject in the book, that we are also a religion and not a race. That ought to be stated very, very clearly. Some people say we're the chosen people. I like to say instead, we are the choosing people. God offered the Torah to everyone. They refused. We accepted. We also say that anyone can join the Jewish fold. We're not a race. If people choose to become converts, they are accepted, and they become as Ruth and as Yisro. They become like anyone else in our people, and Ruth, you all know, is the ancestress of King David, who of course is the ancestor of Mashiach. I think the link is beautiful because here is a convert who comes to us from without, becomes religious. Her descendant is David, who eventually has Messiah, whose role is to bring the entire world precisely to the same point that Ruth got to on her own. What Ruth achieved way back when is what her descendant eventually will do for the entire world. You have a question?
Rabbi, how do we view someone who converts today?
That's so interesting because, indeed, there are people I know who have mixed feelings, and they fail to understand something that is stressed over and over again in our tradition. Are you aware that we say, V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor, but V'yahavtem es hager, and you shall love the convert, is repeated 36 times in the Torah. There is a special measure of love for a convert that's required for a simple and perhaps obvious reason. A convert didn't have to do it. A convert chose to do it. A convert's expression of religion is out of love, clearly and fully. Even within the Jewish fold, we have a fascinating tradition. You know that there are people who came to Judaism on their own, balei tshuva, people who return. And the Talmud teaches us, b'makom shebalei tshuva omdim tzadikim gemurim einam yecholim la'amod. In the place where balei tshuva stand, those who are totally righteous cannot stand, that is to say, they are not their equal, for the simple reason that it took a great deal more courage to get to where they are from their starting point. It took a tremendous amount of courage and conviction on the part of balei tshuva to come to where they now are. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, makes clear a principle about God's judgment. There's very little that we know about how God evaluates people other than this. Lefum tsara agra. It's loosely translated, in accord with the pain is the gain. In accord with the level of difficulty of achieving something is the reward. It certainly is far more difficult for a Baal Tshuva to become religious than it is for me to keep kosher. I'm a 10th generation rabbi. Big deal. I ate kosher all my life. But someone who did it on their own, how wonderful, how much to be applauded, and indeed God does acknowledge that. People ask me, are converts equals of Jews? I would say, at the very least. In the chapters that we read, we also found an allusion to the dialogue between Hasidim and Misnagdim, the two approaches to Jewish life, between the Hasidim, who emphasize the heart, and the Misnagdim, who emphasize the mind. It is a dichotomy that goes back to the Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, who stressed how great is the simple shepherd whose piety is complete because his heart is directed to God in fullness and devotion, and the Vilna Gaon, who maintained that perfection in Judaism comes about by developing one's intellect. These two streams of thought and of emphasis, of course, are still with us to this day. There are two approaches within Judaism I dare say they find their initial expression in an emphasis either on the essence of the first word of the Torah, as some have indicated. In the middle of the word Bereshis is the word Rosh, which means head. And others say, but when you look at the last letter of the Torah, which is Lamed at the conclusion of the word Yisrael, and the first letter of the Torah, which is Bet, the Bet of Bereshis, it's Lev, spells the word heart. And if you ask why it works in reverse order, why the last letter first and then the first letter, it's because you only get to the heart of the Torah after you've gone through it once. You have Rosh and Lev, and these are two ideals, two categories, two concepts, two movements, Hasidim and Misnagdim, each one of which claim they have the key to the truth.
Rabbi Blech, I've taken many classes with a Misnagdish approach, and I've had many classes from more of the Hasidish approach. What is the right path, or what is the real true balance in studying Torah?
I think the right path is what you're doing, taking classes with both, because there is a tradition that a long time ago, the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon were supposed to meet, and that meeting never took place for some reason, we don't know why. And the tradition is that had they come together, not just ironed out their differences, but each one understood the emphasis of the other, and then brought them together as a unified whole, Mashiach would have come. If you ask me today which one is more significant, I think we constantly swing on the pendulum. When the Jewish community went too far to an idolization of head intellect study, it was necessary for Hasidim and Hasidic movement to step in. I think that's what happened within the last few decades. That explains the strength of Hasidism. We were becoming too intellectualized. And Judaism needs heart also. We need fervor. We need singing and dancing. We need kiruv. We need everything that is part and parcel of the Lubavitch movement and others. If the movement strays too far, and if all you get is singing and dancing and no Dvar Torah, if all you get is emotion and a lack of intellect, then you've strayed too far in the other direction. You remember what we had said, middle of this lecture. The essence of Judaism is finding the Derech HaMemutza. Fascinating that the menorah, which is the symbol of ultimate truth, was really constructed in a manner whereby the three on either side of the center shaft inclined towards the middle, says Maimonides, to express the idea that ultimate truth is found in the center, in that position which combines and coalesces the two extremes. I'm glad you took courses in Hasidism and Misnagdism, and I would hope that all of us are able to combine these two concepts in such a way that although the Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov didn't meet, we can create that meeting and thereby bring about the coming of Mashiach. Amen, amen. I thank you very much for being with us today. We will continue, please God, next time.